Yeah, hi. Someone's waving. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to have an opportunity to come here. I am really nervous, and so I'll kind of just put it out there and get that out of the way. I have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is 8/24 of 2017. I have a hard time saying that without like the, just so much gratitude for it. It's like it's the most important date I have in my life today. Drew asked me to come and speak, and I've never actually said no to anything AA's asked. I have this life today that is beyond my wildest dreams, and I'd love to tell you about it. And it's as a result of this program. So when he asked, I obviously didn't want to because I get really anxious, but I said yes. And then he said, oh, by the way, the first Saturday of every month is the circuit speaker, so that's going to be you. And I'm like, what an a-hole. So if this goes really bad, please blame Drew. I have a home group. My home group's Sunday night, Big Book Study. It's in Bountiful. I have a service position. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees. And like I said, I have a life today as a result of these steps. The book tells us that our stories disclose in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. So in a general way, I was raised mostly in Farmington, oldest of six kids. I'm one of six. Drew's five of six, and was raised in a home that was, my growing up was in a home that was very religious. And what I mean by that is, growing up, I always knew what the rules were. And I knew how important those rules were. Looking back at it, I oftentimes didn't know how important I was, but I knew the rules were important. I was someone who always just, I was been diagnosed with a generalized anxiety disorder, someone who was always anxious. I had this way of looking around this world and like I was watching everyone interact. And I'm like, man, that looks like, they look really comfortable right now. And I'm in my head thinking, yeah, I don't do it that way. And that's something that's been with me my whole life. I heard it said once that it seemed like other people had gotten the book on how to live this world, and I just missed that book. And that's quite literally how I felt. I felt like I had a hard time making friends, which is such a weird thing for me, because when I got sober, I maybe had two telephone numbers in my phone I could call. And I look around this room, and it is so full of so many people that I know, that I love, that I'm grateful to see them. And to me, that is just one of the major gifts of recovery. But like, I was raised in this environment where I just was never comfortable. At the age of, like, in between 8th and 9th grade, I remember what happened. I had a friend come over, and he brought over six Smirnoff mini bottles. And my parents were out of town. My dad just got called to be the bishop, so the rules that were important suddenly became extra important. And they were gone, and I drank three of those mini bottles. And the book tells us we drink because of the effect. And I'll tell you the effect it had on me. I went out in the neighborhood that night. It was the first time in my life I could remember actually making eye contact with girls. I felt like I was funny. I thought the people around me thought I was funny. And I realized that there was a way that I was going to fit into this world. And that was before I even hit 9th grade. I had this sense at the time that it wasn't probably the best move for me. But the one thing that I knew was that I was going to do it again. And so I kept that going, and I'll just kind of fast forward, but all through high school and the end of junior high, that kept going. And what happened is I was behind my house one day having a cigarette, and it was a Saturday, and everyone was gone, and my dad, the bishop, came home, and they came home a couple hours early. And my dad came around the side of the house, and he looked at me, and he said, "I've warned you 50 times about smoking here." And I'm going to tell you that was probably a lie. My guess is he may have warned me 100. And he said, "Put yourself in a bag. You've got to go." And I moved down to Salt Lake with some friends of mine. And my story has two parts, so I'm just telling you the first part right now. But I moved down to Salt Lake with some friends of mine. And what happened is I didn't realize I had this disease. And what I've learned for me with this disease is that I have a tendency to cross lines I said I'd never cross. I know I'm at an AA speaker meeting, and so I want to give respect to that, but it wasn't very long until I was doing drugs I said I'd never do. I was not going to do cocaine. Heroin was out of the question. I'm afraid of needles. And it wasn't that long before I had a needle in my arm, and I was shooting up heroin and cocaine on a daily basis, and I was 18 years old. What happened in my life, the thing that changed then was that I got a phone call from my mom, who I hadn't seen in months or spoken to, and she said, "Hey, I need to come and see you." And my response to that was, "You know what, there's no way you're coming in this apartment." And she said, "I don't think you understand. I don't care to see the apartment. I need to see you." And she drove down to Salt Lake. This is 30 years ago, and I can still remember sitting in the apartment, looking out the window, and not having the courage to walk down the steps to see my mom. I was so ashamed at what I'd become. And when I went down, she just said, "Hey, we want to help you." And it was within no time that I was in a detox, and I was on my way to a treatment center in Arizona. And it's a interesting thing. I went down there, and it was the first time in my life I felt like I was around people that I like could relate to. I was around people that it felt like they understood me. I was 19 years old, and I was just trying to figure it out. And after that, I thought I had this great plan with my life. So I came back. I got a degree in psychology. I went to the Graduate School of Social Work. To become a licensed substance abuse counselor, thinking that, like, this is what I was going to do. And got married, started a family, decided I'd go get some more schooling, so I went to the Y, real close to here, and got an MBA. So I did part of it at the U of U and part of it at the Y. Don't hate. I had no path. Like, if you look at that as far as, like, a education and a career path, all that is like someone who is so afraid that they stay in school because school felt safe. And that's what I did. And I had graduated from the MBA program. I'm trying not to spend too much time in this part of my life, but I think it's important. Decided to change career path, decided to do something else with my life. And as we read on the bottom of page 60, it talks about being the actor and the director and arranging the lights, the scenery, the ballet, the whole show. And I was doing that with my life. And I'll tell you, at that time, it really felt like the show was coming off pretty well. I'd love to take you to a really specific day in my life. And I'll tell you what happened. It was St. Patrick's Day of 2003. My son, who's here with me tonight, was 2 years old. He was getting ready to turn 3. My wife was pregnant with our twins. And I got a phone call that night. And I'd just gotten this new job. We were moving down to Las Vegas. Like, I'm telling you, life was good. And that night, I got a phone call from the doctor. And the doctor said, "John, we got your test results back." And they came back suspicious. And I had no idea what suspicious meant. So I remember just saying, "Okay, cool. What's suspicious?" And he said, "John, you have cancer." And I was 28 years old. And he said, I'm going to clear my schedule tomorrow morning. I need you to clear yours and come right in. And so I went in and met with the doctor. And I asked him what the prognosis was. And he said, you have stage 4 thyroid cancer. And he said, in these scenarios, the worst case scenario is I give you 6 months. And I sat with him for another 5 minutes, and I have no idea what else he said. All of that fear came up. They sent me into surgery pretty quickly. As a result of the first surgery, they severed a branch of my spinal accessory nerve. And this was in 2003, and I was given non-addictive OxyContin. And I thought, okay, like, I'm good. And I thought for a while in my life, tried to remember how much pain I was in. And I don't actually remember how much pain I was in. But I remember that every time I took something, the fear of dying, not being around to see my kids grow up, went away. I went in for a surgery. The first one went pretty bad. I went in for radiation and all the other things. I went in for another surgery and more treatments, and they couldn't seem to get it all. And somehow, 3 years later, I was still alive. And I went for a surgery in Rochester, Minnesota at the Mayo Clinic. And I remember going into that surgery, and I remember after the surgery, the doctor came to me after the scans and said, hey, I've got great news for you. And he said, we've got it all. And I remember what I was thinking at the time, that would be great news. And my thought was, now, what am I going to do with my life? I knew I was hooked on pills. I was drinking a bottle a night to be able to fall asleep. And then I had this great idea that, John, you have a master's degree in this. Pull yourself out of it. That was in 2006. My sobriety date is August 24th, 2017. So for the next 11 years, I worked to pull myself out of it. When I went to treatment, I hadn't read the big book at the time. I didn't realize that self-knowledge would avail me nothing. And man, did I put a lot of self-knowledge into this disease. And it's an interesting disease for me because it's one of those things that the harder I worked on it, the worse it got, and the worse it got, the more I felt like I needed to put effort into it. In my head, I thought I was doing all these things to solve it, so we moved from Las Vegas, where we were living, up to Utah. And I thought, well, Vegas has to be the problem. I mean, I know someone's in here who's been to Vegas. And when I lived there for 7 years, like, that had to be the problem. And so when we moved up, the problem became that I brought the wrong person with me. I brought me. And I didn't realize I was the problem. My wife and I, we had another kid. This kid's absolutely delightful. If anyone's in the audience thinking the kid's going to fix the problem, like, I wouldn't change having this kid, but it didn't fix the problem for me. I wouldn't trade having the kid, though. This guy's awesome. His name's Cash. And it was a couple years ago, he was probably 6. So 9 years ago, I asked him if he had a middle name. It's like the fun things parents get to do. It's like you just mess with them when they're younger. And I'm like, Cash, you got a middle name? And he goes, yeah, I think so. He said, it's money, cash money. I looked at this kid, and all I could think is, what the hell? And he goes, yeah, Dad, all my uncles call me cash money. And so I have him saved in my phone now as cash money. Like, it's probably the most delightful kid in the world. But he didn't solve the problem. There was a point through all of this, before I got sober, that my parents and my in-laws had gotten together to figure out if they could petition with the state to put me on permanent disability. Never thinking I would be a part of this world again. Looking back at it, the hardest part for me is I thought they might be right. When it talks about hopelessness, I was in a place of complete hopelessness. A couple things happened in my life. Some of the things that happened was my brother got sober. And we used to be around each other and we used to hang out a lot. And then I never saw him. I couldn't hold any jobs. I got to a point where I had a hard time applying for a job because I knew if I got the job, they'd spend the next 2 months trying to figure out how to get rid of me. So I got to this point where I had this job that was selling logo equipment, like logo, like hats and pens and different things. And it was commission only, and I could barely leave the house, so I didn't make any money. But I had business cards with my name on it. So I felt like I was something. And that's where I had gotten. That's what it used to be like for me. What happened in the summer of 2017, my in-laws had given their side of the family a trip to Newport Beach, California for Christmas. Actually, Oceanside, but they spent time up in Newport. And I love Newport Beach. Like, if you haven't been there, it's like Park City, but on the ocean. And somehow it's always 75 degrees, but it's like the right kind of 75. It's always amazingly comfortable. And I was pretty excited to go. And it was a couple days before the trip. And my wife came to me and she let me know that I wasn't going. And she's heard me tell this story a few times. And it was a few years ago where she came to me and she says, "Man, you keep telling people you were uninvited on the trip." And she goes, "You were actually never invited to start with. I just had to be the one to tell you." And that was harsh, but accurate. And what happened was they went on this trip, and I was talking to my kids. My oldest son was 17 at the time, the one who's here. My twins were 14. My youngest was 9 years old, cash money. And they were telling me it was the best vacation they ever had. And I knew they were right because I wasn't there to ruin it. I knew they were right. And I was home, and I didn't know what options I had. I had quite literally put everything I could think of into this disease, into fighting it, into figuring out my way around it. And I had gotten to this place where I had you know that place where life feels so heavy? It is like so heavy. Our book has the perfect words for it because it calls it pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I remember waking up one morning thinking, man, life has never been this heavy before. If I can survive today, tomorrow has to be better. And I got through the day and I woke up the next morning and it was worse. And I really felt like I was out of options. I went through the house and I locked all the doors and I pulled the blinds, which was like a really weird thing to do because I wasn't a guy anybody came to visit ever. And I did the only thing I could think of. And I went downstairs and I sat on a bed and I locked that door. And And I said the most sincere prayer I've ever said, which was simply, God, if there's a way out of this, please help me. And shortly after that prayer, the job I was holding on to for business cards called me and said, hey, you're not welcome in the office anymore. Please don't tell anyone you work here. My wife came home from Newport Beach, or from California with the kids, and it probably won't shock anybody that they extended their trip a week. But when they got home, we took the dog on a walk around the park, and she looked at me and said, hey, I don't care if we stay married or get divorced anymore. I don't even care. All I know is you have to leave. And I was looking at my kids and couldn't even get them to really make eye contact with me. And so I thought, well, I'll run up to my parents' house because they put four of their kids in treatment and they've like never been a part of Al-Anon. So I'm like, great enablers. And I went up there and I thought, okay, guys, I'm ready to move in. They looked at me and they said, you know, we'll help you, but we're not going to help you your way anymore. And it was the day after that I had a chance to go to treatment. And I had this belief in my life today that it seems to have been proven time after time, is that sometimes when I feel like my world is completely falling apart, it's God's way of bringing it together. Everything that was important to me at that time, I felt like I had lost. But I was in the middle of it, and I couldn't see what was happening. I couldn't see how it was coming together. And I went into treatment, and I remember being in treatment, and I was talking with one of the therapists there, and she, I was explaining to her about like my education and all the stuff I knew, and she looked at me, this is probably 2 or 3 days into it, and she said, you know what you're going to have to do? And I'm thinking I'm going to get like the junior therapist badge. I'm like, yeah, let's go. What do I have to do? She said, you know what, you're going to have to forget all that BS you think you know, because none of it kept you sober. And it was this realization that I had at that time that I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. I didn't even understand what this disease was. I didn't realize in my life until I was there and been separated from it for a little while that when it talks about the two questions that we can ask ourselves to determine if we're an alcoholic, at the beginning of We Agnostics, it says, like, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. I don't know how many times I said I'd never do that again. The three Christmases, three in a row, before I got sober, I remember hiding out in a room in the basement, just sobbing. I'm never going to do this to my family again. And it just kept getting worse. So with that, when I honestly wanted to, I found I could not quit entirely and my hand went right up there. And then the next question was, if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take. And I can't tell you how many times I went for two drinks. Just two. I was in an AA meeting early on, and I heard an old timer say, I'm not a guy who can have one drink. And the reason I can't do it is because the person who orders the second drink is a different person. And it was the first time I heard something that made sense to me. I always started with a plan. It's my one of my favorite things with the sponsees I work with when they tell me they've got a plan. I'm like, okay, man, I could use a laugh. Like, let's hear the plan. You know, and I'd gotten to a point where it was bad enough. I thought it was Tito's was my problem. I thought sometimes it was the outfit I was wearing. I'm like, man, every time I wear that shirt and those shoes, bad night. Like, bad night. Never putting that combination together again. And I didn't actually realize that I was the problem. So I started going through this process, and it was tough. I was in treatment on my 20-year wedding anniversary, so if anyone's looking for ideas on how to spend a 20, I would not put that on the list. And the night of the 20 was the first night that we had a couples processing session. And so my wife came in that night, and I remember I thought it was going remarkably well. And the counselor said, hey, what is it you want to see out of him? And she goes, I want him never to drink again. I want him never to relapse. And this giant of a man looked at her and just kind of laughed. Started laughing on his chair, and it was teetering. And he said, he can't promise that. But what he can promise is that he'll be honest and transparent going forward. And if he does that, you'll see a relapse long before it ever happens. And for me, I believe there are times in this world where I actually hear something, and times in this world where I feel it. And when he said that, I felt it. And I knew that's what I had to do. So I made that promise. And then after that, we had some hard conversations, and I saw my wife of 20 years drive away that night, and two things happened after getting honest. One, I thought I was never going to see her again, and the other thing that happened was this backpack that I'd been carrying that had to be 200 pounds, it finally got to set down. I was in a place that took us to a lot of meetings. And in the meetings, they'd always read how it works. I had a book I was going through. I was a little compartmentalized. I didn't actually realize that the first paragraph of How It Works talks about honesty till like a month into doing it every day. It talks about being constitutionally capable of being honest with ourselves, grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty, and having the capacity to be honest. And I remember when that hit me, it like blew my mind. I'm like, wow, has anyone else seen this? And I knew that like part of it for me is that I had to be honest. Honesty for me is a scary thing. I'm pretty sure my dad's never like hit his knees in the morning and asked to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. I've done that every morning for 6.5 years. I don't think I'm actually an honest guy on my own. I think for me, the reason why I get to be an honest person today, or at least more honest than I used to be, something I strive for, is because I get help. Had a few things happen in treatment. One of the things that happened was the therapist, and we're getting out of the treatment set here, but this is part of like what it's like now, but the therapist told me that I had to go get a job at Costco when I got out. And I remember yelling at him, telling him how important I thought I was, explaining that my that there wasn't a way for me to provide for 4 kids at $13 an hour. And he said, no, you're not listening. He said, if you want to get sober, you need to go get a job where you can show up, put in an honest day's work, and go home. And it was 2 days after leaving treatment, I got this job at Costco. and I, or at least I applied for it. I got it like shortly thereafter, and I was in the IOP program for treatment, and I thought it was great because Costco had scheduled me the same nights I was supposed to be in treatment, and I'm thinking, man, treatment told me to get the job. I got the job. Now I don't have to go to treatment. Like, I'll just show up and stock produce, which was the section I was in. And remember, some of my kids were teasing me because I'd come home with my name badge that said Jonathan Produce, and they're like, "Great, Dad." But it had been so long since I had a job that actually wanted me to show up. It had been so long since I was a part of something. So I went to this job and I told them I needed a couple nights a week off. And they told me, we don't do that for new people. And I don't know if anyone's been inside Costco. Costco's big. And Costco has like A office. And inside the A office, there's a special office. And I had to go meet with the general manager in the special office, talk about getting these nights off. And I had all these things in my head that I could tell her. And I said a quick little prayer, and I realized that I just had to be honest. So she came to me, and she said, "Hey, I know you need these nights off. Why is that?" And her name was Sandy, and I looked at Sandy, and I took a breath, and I said, "Sandy, I am an alcoholic, and I'm in recovery. And I'm trying to learn how to be a dad and an employee and a husband again, and I need these classes to help." And she got up from behind the desk, and she gave me a hug, and she said, "We will never schedule you those nights." She said, "No one's ever honest with me when they come in here, and you're honest because I can feel it." And I left her office that day on cloud nine. Costco taught me a lot. I'm not an early morning person. Some people are. Some people are really good at like 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. And that's never been in my wheelhouse. And Costco started scheduling me at 4 a.m. And my alarm would go off at 3:03. Because just three sounded way too early. And when the alarm would go off, I'd hit that alarm and I'd just say, "Okay, you can show up today. Just today." If you would have put 6 months on a schedule of me waking up and being at work at 4 a.m., it never would have happened. I wouldn't have shown up day one. But Costco taught me how to show up one day at a time. I was leaving work one day, and I remember I was looking to get a hot dog, and I was walking up to the recovery club that was only three blocks away, and we had one family car, and we had three drivers, and I was for sure the lowest person on the totem pole. And I was walking up to the recovery club, and I was starving, and I thought, "Well, I'll just get a hot dog and a drink. $1.62 at Costco." And I was with all my buddies that I worked with, and I went to check out, and the guy behind the counter looked at me and said, "Tells me you have insufficient funds." And I remember putting the backpack on my shoulder, leaving, thinking, "Man, screw this. Like, I can't do this anymore." And my sponsor, old Bill, used to always tell me, "John, wherever you go, take your higher power with you." And that was super new for me. I thought at best I checked in the morning, I checked out in the afternoon or at night, and kind of what I did during the day ended up being my business. And I remember walking out of there thinking, "Okay, you know what? I'm having this conversation that, hey, I'm told I'm supposed to take you with you. Take you with me." And someone taught me this prayer early on, so I used it, which is, "God, they tell me you're not going to give me more than I can handle. But I think you got way too much faith in your boy right now because I'm not handling this very well. And I need your help." And by the time I had crossed the street, there were three birds singing in a tree. I looked up at the mountains. I'd lived by these mountains most of my life, and at 43 years old, these mountains had never been more beautiful. And I had this thought that, John, you get to stay sober today. For 3 years up until me getting help, I couldn't have a sober day. I was not a guy who even, like, I got to the point where all I wanted was a sober AM. If I just make the AM sober, that's success. And I couldn't even do that. And I was getting ready to throw it away for a hot dog. And I started working the steps with Bill. And part of it was I was meeting with him, and we got to step three, which is made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understood him. And he asked me what God was. And I thought, man, I've got this. Like when I was younger, I did a study abroad in Jerusalem as well. So I was explaining God as far as Judaism, Islam, Christianity. Like I was like, man, I got God. I was waiting for the little gold star after this conversation. And little Bill from Kentucky looked at me, and he's about this big. And he just said, boy, the one thing that's clear to me is you don't know shit about God. And and then he said, the sentence that's most important to you is that you recognize that God could and would if you were sought. And he said, John, be a seeker. Super grateful for Bill. That was 6 years and 4 months ago. And to the best of my ability, imperfectly, I've tried to be a seeker every day. Bill gave me some other advice. He told me to leave my big book open on my bedside table, page 86 and 87, and read it morning and night. One morning I was calling him. I was completely like shot out. I had all these things I had to do, and called Bill, and I told him about all the stuff on my plate that day. He said, well, are you taking your higher power with you? And I thought, oh, Bill, I forgot to pray this morning. He goes, well, it tells us on awakening. He goes, let me give you a really good rule of thumb. He said, try to spend 30 minutes a morning in prayer and meditation. He goes, read what you need to read. He said, unless you're having a really busy day like you are today and you got to wake up early. And in my head, I was thinking, there's my out. And Bill said, on these days, spend an hour. And to the best of my ability, I've tried to do that every day since. I don't know how to function very well in this world on my own. Thank God today I don't have to. I left Costco. I have a night that I'd love to tell you guys about in my life. I have so many amazing stories and amazing nights, but this one really stands out. So I got to be sober on Thanksgiving, which was tough for some reason. I don't know why. Christmas, which seemed pretty easy. New Year's, which was weird. Sober on my wife's birthday. Sober on Cash's birthday. I was sober on my oldest son's birthday, on my birthday. And the one birthday that was coming up next was the twins. And they wanted to have their birthday party at Classic Skate. And I don't know if anyone here, I see a smile, so I don't know if anyone here has actually been to Classic Skate or familiar with it. Classic Skate quite literally is my version of hell. And I tell people that is probably a lie, because I actually think hell may sound funner than Classic Skate. And I'm not sure what hell is, but it's Classic Skate's probably below hell, and they wanted to have their birthday party there. And my wife had worked with some of the other parents to set up a, to rent out the place. And I remember showing up to this birthday party. And I remember thinking, it's going to be the worst night of my life. I remember thinking, I don't have gifts. I'm still trying to rebuild my life. I don't know how to do it. And then old Bill, John, take your higher power with you. So I said a prayer and I started walking in, and something happened as I was walking in, and I realized that night was not about me. Which is weird for a guy who's selfish and self-centered, where everything's about him. So I put a smile on my face and I put on some roller skates. And I'm not roller skate coordinated. I don't know how that works. I tell people probably the analogy is like a giraffe and strobe lights going around the rink. Like, that was me splashing out at all the turns with a big smile on my face, and I did that for about 3 hours. I went home that night, and I thought, man, that was an okay night. And one of the twins, my son Charlie, came into the room. And he said, thank you, Dad. That's the best birthday I ever had. And shortly after, his twin came in and said the same thing. And it didn't dawn on me until that night that that was the first time their dad had ever been sober on their birthday. I wasn't planning on seeing him turn one. I love recovery. Part of the reason I feel like I love recovery is because it allows me to do the things that dads get to do. It allows me to show up in ways that I was never able to show up before on my own. It allows me to be a friend, and I cannot even believe how many I get to have here tonight. And it allows me to be a part of this world. The part of the principles in recovery, like, we get to use them all the time. My son who's here, there was a time that he was struggling with something, and he had made the decision to go on a mission, which I supported. It was just like, man, whatever your decision is, man, I got you. Come with you, whatever it is. And he called me and he said, Dad, I said, I don't know if I can do this. I said, okay. And he said, yeah, I don't know if I can do this for 2 years. I said, I don't know if you can either, but I know you can do it today. That's how I look at my sobriety. By a lot of grace I get today. I used to tell my wife all the time that, like, I'm doing okay today, like, I might drink tomorrow, and just watch her spin off like a top, like. But for me, when tomorrow comes, I'll check my watch, and as long as my watch tells me it's today, I know that's the day I stay sober. I don't know how to stay sober for 20 years. Thank God I don't have to. Like, I get to stay sober today. I remember meeting with my sponsor and telling him how I was so embarrassed about, like, some of the stuff in my past. And I thought, man, there's, like, I've been such a mess for so long. And some of the crap I did is unbelievable. And he opened our book to page 124. There's a part in there that says, Henry Ford once made the wise remark that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. This is only true if one's able to turn the past into good account. And then the next paragraph talks about how the alcoholic's past becomes a principal asset. And with it, we get to help others avert death and misery. And he said, John, you golf. He goes, why don't you just look at this like you're God's caddy? He goes, you're going to have someone who comes to you at some point and said, I don't know what to do here. And you just pull out the iron and you say, man, this is what we do here. I am so grateful for my past today. Through the steps, I've been able to turn that disaster into something that helps others. I've gotten an opportunity to be a new person. I get to realize that I have this huge power in my life. And when my sponsor told me that I don't understand God at all, and that I needed to switch the wording in step three to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I don't understand him, I'm going to tell you today I have a huge God in my life. Huge. This God's able to watch over my family. Able to keep the planet spinning around the sun. This God is my employer. He's the actor, he's the director, he's the principal, he is the father. And I don't know if I understand this God at all. I feel like the closer I get to it, the less I understand it. But the one thing today I know with a certainty is that this God understands me. Because I get to feel that. And I get to walk through this world with more peace than I've ever had. I know there's a way to do it. I'm grateful we've got so many people here who are newer. I remember being in a meeting, picking up my 90-day chip, thinking, man, if these guys had any idea of the shit rolling around in my head, they wouldn't give me this chip. But I knew I had stayed sober. And old Bill told me, he said, John, got good news for you. He said, the 12 steps work like an adjustable wrench for every nut who walks through the door. He goes, you're going to be all right. I thought, okay, let's keep trying it. I have a life today that is quite literally beyond my wildest dreams. I used to complain that life wasn't fair and how unfair life was. And now for me, I just think, man, thank God life's not fair. Fair to me would be I'd be at the point of the mountain if life was fair. And it's not fair for me today. So I get this life I cannot believe I get to live. When I turned 4 years sober, I was, I'll close with this story. When I turned 4 years sober, I was working at this place, and it was the morning I turned four, and I was so excited because I had never really been four before. And I showed up to this place, and the owner of this place pulled me aside that morning, and he said, John, you're like, he's a baseball analogy guy, and I never really played baseball, so he's like, hey, you're the best player we got. I can put you in the field at any position. I know you'll field it well. I'm thinking, okay, I'm slightly following. And then he said, but you're also like one of our most expensive employees, so I'm going to let you go. And I remember driving down the mountain that day, and I called my younger brother, Drew. because Drew didn't give up on me. Drew helped me get into sobriety. And I call him on my birthday and I always thank him. And he said, well, what's going on? And I explained to him how I got laid off. And towards the end of the call, Drew said, well, congratulations. And I said, well, man, it's been a great 4 years. And I'm trying not to say this word at the pulpit, so I won't. And he said, not on that, you effing idiot. He said, congratulations on God moving you where you couldn't move yourself. And that's been another example of, like, sometimes when I feel like my world's falling apart, it's God's way of bringing it together. Because what I get to do now is not something I could have even dreamed of while that was happening. I used to tell people that Costco was the best job I ever had. And it was a good one. It's for sure second on the list. Because what I get to do now is the best thing that I've ever done. And I get to be a part of this world in a way that I never thought possible. I'd like to just end with this quote out of the book. And it's on page 100. And it is two of my favorite sentences. And it says, when we look back, we realize the things that came into our life when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Trust the dictates of a higher power, and you will live in a new and wonderful world, regardless of your current circumstances. Sorry for talking so long. I love you guys. Thank you.